In order to rally people, governments need enemies. They want us to be afraid, to hate, so we will rally behind them. And if they do not have a real enemy, they will invent one in order to mobilize us. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. Today, I'm joined by Monica Perez, the co-host of the Propaganda Report. Ms. Perez, where is the best place to find your podcast and collection of work?
Thank you for asking. The Propaganda Report is a free 30-minute daily news feed on your favorite podcasting platform. And we also do patreon.com/propagandareport for lots of extra stuff, commercial-free content, 45 minutes every day of daily news. And then we have a fantastic deep dive series on rockfin.com/propagandareport. And my website's thepropreport.com, where we have a continuous player, so you can just turn it on and clean the garage and just listen to the week's shows.
The Prop Report on a loop. Oh my gosh, that is worth going out of your way for. So today we are going to be discussing what's commonly referred to as the Unabomber Manifesto, also known as Industrial Society and Its Future by Theodore John Kaczynski. Please, before you jump into the comment section, I know that Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. We still need to be able to appreciate Jefferson's ideas and contributions. I know Kaczynski did terrible things. We're talking about the ideas, for heaven's sake. Throw him in the intellectual river of history for all I care. Ms. Perez, you and I did our biggest 10 takeaways. I want to go through all of yours first. So please give us what you thought was your first biggest takeaway from this book.
One of the major takeaways goes right to what you just said, and that is that the book is very interesting, really moving in that it's very well written, very simple, very easy to understand, and very persuasive. But he admits himself in the course of either it's the actual manifesto or the book, Technological Slavery, that has some other stuff in it, that most of these ideas are really not original, that the number one thinker in this area is Jacques Ellul, E-L-L-U-L, who wrote Technological Society. He also wrote Propaganda. And his position was, he was either something like a Christian anarchist or a spiritualist anarchist like Tolstoy. He would have had the exact opposite approach. He was very, very peaceful. So I would say if you can read this as a way to easily comprehend the concepts, because Ellul is very hard to read. But yes, you don't need to take the Kaczynski taint with you to the ideas.
Excellent point. I thought one of the biggest takeaways for people like us is he is starting, let me just give you the thesis of his thing. Here's the first sentence. The Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. That's his thesis, which he later defends. Now, people like us should be able to appreciate how hard it is to fight the uphill battle of everyone thinking your ideas not only are wrong, are so beyond ridiculous. Anarchism and capitalism, that's like chaos plus exploitation. How could you believe in such a thing? But he's able to convince you by the end of it. You go, you know, I think he's wrong, but he's not crazy. And I think we have so much to learn. And it's this. So my copy is this thin. It's like 100 pages. Yours obviously has a lot more additions to it. Any thoughts on that?
The biggest, and I'm going to go this as my next takeaway, his most compelling theory is how he articulates what he calls the power principle. And I'll tell you what that is. There's four elements to it. And the fourth element, you ever have that experience where this is why I think philosophy should not be taught like in high schools. It should be taught in like retirement homes. It's that when you see a philosophical truth of really profound, fundamental value, you only understand it if you already somehow observed it. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you the four things, and I'll tell you why the last one is so important. The power principle is four things. Goal, you have to have a goal. That goal needs to require effort. It cannot be an easy to attain goal for it to be satisfying. You need to be able to attain the goal. So this is what the human drive like is based on: setting important goals, non-trivial goals, putting effort out to achieve the goals, and attaining the goal. The fourth thing is that it has to be done autonomously. I think that goes to this idea of free will, of using your own agency, of being responsible. It really goes to my favorite thing of Harry Brown's definition of the libertarian. We believe in individual liberty and personal responsibility on all issues at all times. Autonomy is a big part of that. And then for me, I remember I was a radio host on WSB in Atlanta, and it was stressful. I like had stage fright, whatever. But I used to be an investment banker, which was also very stressful. But the difference was, and I always was like, I don't have to quit this job, even though it's insanely stressful and pays next to nothing, because it's so satisfying to pursue something totally independently of other people's control, because I had just such a great boss. And I identified very clearly that was why that job was satisfying. And it was a goal that was hard to affect. It was a very hard thing. Every week it was hard. I attained the goal. I put out good ideas. I got feedback. And so the power principle, I think, speaks to why we are so dissatisfied. And this is going to go to something I want to talk about later, which is in a state of nature, this is the norm. In the state of technology, this is the exception.
Excellent points there. So the real world examples that came to mind when thinking about this, because this is like a real thing about people, you know, striving for a goal, getting it and not feeling fulfilled because it's not actually the power process done through with the overarching autonomy. There's a joke in Seinfeld where they ask Newman why people at the post office go crazy every now and then. And he says, well, because the mail never stops. It just keeps coming in. And the more that goes out, the more that comes in, and it never stops. There's no structure. And that was so funny because, like, if you're a construction worker, at the end of the day, you're able to drive by something and you say, my dad was a construction worker. Every time we drive by, I go, here it's coming. You know, I actually help. Yes, yes. It, same story. They get so much fulfillment out of that, like, real tangible thing. The other one, it's a funny Family Guy. I get that these are shows, but they represent something real. Peter and the chicken are constantly fighting to the death in the most elaborate ways. And the chicken finally dies, and Peter brings him back to life. And he goes, you're my arch nemesis. Why'd you bring me back to life? And he goes, well, I need you. I need something to fight against. And we constantly see this symbiotic relationship between the very things you hate give you meaning, which give them meaning, which gives you something to hate and something to stand for. You see it all the time. I just heard it on the radio the other day. There's a Billie Eilish song where she says, I had a dream. I got everything I wanted. And on second thought, it might have been a nightmare. Because getting everything you want, you're still not able to go through the power process or the power principle. So, I think that is the biggest takeaway. Any final thoughts on that and your third takeaway?
Okay, two things. One is, I had the same experience. My father was a welder, and we would drive by far, far away, see it in the distance, the Twin Towers. And he would say, I worked on the sixth basement of the Twin Towers. And then when I got a job nearby at the American Express building, which is probably not even there anymore for that reason, because of 9/11, but my brother said, oh, he sent me a picture of himself standing on the scaffolding, building that building back in the day. He was much older than I was. And so I have that exact same experience for these construction workers. I mean, they are really proud of their buildings, and I don't blame them at all. And that brings me to the second point I have, which is what you said about struggling and the chicken and the Family Guy. What my brother and father were creating, they were creating that, and they were proud of it. You point out that even in destroying, is you have that satisfaction. And that's a very interesting point to make, because that's the dog that doesn't bark. In the power principle, the goal, the effort, the attainment, the autonomy, he never says it has to be creative. He actually thinks creativity is a surrogate activity, which is my third point.
Just before we get to that one, I can't help but notice when people are arguing over things, especially in our world of politics, it's almost like they talk about how they want their side to win, but they can never accept a win. So when the military gets $800 billion a year, they're like, damn Obama cutting the military. when it was just microscopic, it's still 10 times, you know, Russia and China combined, or, you know, what we want those who are poor to get wealthy. Well, there's a lot more wealth among the poor than there was in 1700, 1800. Not a win for them. But the lack of sexism, much less bad today than it was in 1960, 1860, whatever. Racism is the big one. They can't assume. I mean, Gallup, originally, it was like 3% of Americans supported interracial marriage in like 1900. And today it's like 87. So they don't even focus on it. More equality is another thing where, yes, but Warren Buffett is a lot wealthier than I am, but I still have a ton of printers and computers and microphones and access to information with my computers, that it's not like we're on different planets. Whereas the king and the peasants were more or less on different planets at the last time. They can't accept this win. What do you think about Kaczynski's idea that it tends to be the left, but it also applies to the right, that even if you gave them everything they wanted, they would then invent problems, as he says on page 9. If our society had no problems at all, leftists would have to invent problems in order to provide themselves with an excuse for making a fuss.
I think that goes to the surrogate activity point, which is, he says that a surrogate activity, so in the state of nature, the goal is satisfying your physical needs, that it takes effort, and that you must attain the goal, and you do it autonomously, and then you're satisfied. Today, we have surrogate activities that are meant to make us feel like we have important goals that we attain and pursue. He includes as those scientific pursuits, athletic achievement, art and literary creation. So creativity to him in that way is a surrogate activity. He talks about climbing the corporate ladder. This is going to answer your question. And acquiring money beyond what you need to satisfy yourself in any way goes against your question. And social activism, especially by proxy. And what he's saying is the reason those things are never-ending goals, and I'm going to really, especially in answer to your question, climbing the social ladder, achieving material acquisition, acquisitiveness, and social activism by proxy. So fighting for the BLM, Black Lives Matter, as a white suburban teenager. So he says that you're never satisfied because it's not really your internal goal. It's not a necessity. It's not truly important. So even if you set that goal and satisfy it, achieve it, it will not satisfy you. So you cannot sleep at the end of the night. It just comes back. And I think that goes to your Newman thing too.
Well, think of the perfect example, and this is, you know, something that just pushed AOC from, you know, someone energetic but a little misled to just a bad person. She had posted pictures of my abuela's home was ruined in the Puerto Rican hurricane. It's the Trump administration. So she's explicitly saying government welfare doesn't work. So first of all, I loved it. But then she was like, this is horrible. This is why, you know, we need help and a bigger government. So Matt Walsh at the Daily Caller says, well, you have a Tesla. You're wealthy enough, but obviously you can't help her. So we're going to give it a shot. They raised about $130,000 in 10 hours for her to give to AOC, to give to her aunt, to which they contacted GoFundMe. I promise this is a true story. I waited 3 days to say anything because I go, AOC's going to expose that this guy just made it up. This is a real story. He was on Tucker Carlson talking about it. They called GoFundMe to say, please stop the funds because we won't be accepting them. So according to the official story, Abuela is dying and homeless, and she then stops Matt Walsh from giving her $130,000.
Walsh is the
amazing
guy.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Walsh is the Daily Caller guy who works with Ben Shapiro. So that is literally a case of them inventing a problem. There's probably no abuela who's still in Puerto Rico. It's probably all fake. But when
or
you see something like that.
Or summer place where AOC goes, or yeah. Winter place, you know what I mean? Like
really. But that is a perfect example of, look, this has nothing to do with a problem. If it wasn't poverty, it'd be global warming. If it wasn't global warming, it would be racism, or it would be climate change, or it would be overpopulation. They just need something to fight against.
Right. I agree with that.
What is your next point?
It's my fourth one. It's that the basic needs, your basic necessities, and I always thought that basic necessities like farming or whatever wouldn't be intellectual enough for someone like me who I really like thoughts. And then I had an interview with Bellamy Fitzpatrick, who has, he's an interesting creative person who has a permaculture. He's establishing a little permaculture for himself and his wife up in upstate New York. And it's a couple of acres. I actually visited it and everything. And by the end of my conversation with him, my first conversation, he made it clear to me, it was just instantly how satisfying, how intellectually and physically satisfying it is for him to solve those problems, because to master that environment, to recreate the Garden of Eden, isn't passive. It's active, and it would employ even our drive. So Kaczynski, for example, was the youngest person up till that time to get accepted to Harvard. And he went to Harvard at the age of 16, where he was a victim of MK Ultra or MK Ultra style psychological activities, which would be considered totally unethical today. He was possibly the youngest professor at Berkeley. He was a math professor at Berkeley. So this is a guy who had real intellectual capacity beyond anything I could imagine. And he is saying that these things are what is satisfying, and this is a choice that he made to live, although he obviously used his mind to do some super destructive things. But my point is that these basic needs that you would satisfy are do require real effort of your entire body and mind, and that the reason that the power principle is so gutted, neutralized, neutered, is that you have no autonomy in fulfilling those basic necessities. That, so your surrogate activities are the ones where you have autonomy, so you can paint a picture. But as we see with the COVID times, outside of homesteaders, we have to rely on other people for getting our needs. So it's very easy to get them. You need food for this day. You get a minimum wage job. That's enough to feed you for one day. Then you go to a store where they have offerings that you then purchase, but to have a minimum wage job or to have an average job, all you're doing is taking orders and obeying. And then you're converting that into food. But again, there's no real autonomy in that.
That is so important, because I remember the last relationship I was in, a lot of the fights were, I felt like she was, you know, bossing me around, whatever. Even saying it out loud, it's so trivial and so ridiculous. It's like, look, first world country, I got a good job, I have a girlfriend, we have our own place, I have so little to complain about. But I hated it so much when she'd say, can you do this? And in the middle of doing that, she goes, oh, and can you do that? Hey, did you ever do that? I really wanted that done. Hey, and then the second I get back from doing the third thing, she's like, hey, did you do the fourth thing? Now, granted, this is like one right after another, but it's like, you know, 20 minutes or so of my time. Very small. It drove me up the wall every single time. But even I would pause at the time and I go, so this is pissing me off to no end, but what do I have to complain about? I have things so good, yet I'm about to tell her it's over. What is going on?
What's going on here?
And it's the same thing Kaczynski's talking about.
I see that in all of my family relationships. Like, it is harder for someone to do something, even if they want to do it, if you ask them to do it. Like, literally, I will sit there on the couch and I'll like pause the TV to talk to my kids or whatever. And so they're finished, they walk away, and I'm about to unpause it. And my husband says, okay, could you unpause it? And I'm like, really? Do you really have to talk? Really? You know, I need autonomy. Like, that's why we want the remote. Like, we want, you know, it's not just control, it's autonomy. They should call it remote autonomy.
Next time he pulls it, just turn the TV off, pull out Technological Slavery and start quoting from it exactly. But
I'm
by
not
the time
committed to do that in my house. He thinks it's a bad influence on the kids.
That's funny. What is your fifth point? Your fifth takeaway from industrial society and its future.
Okay. He says that the abnormal, that our social problems come from abnormal conditions of life, that modern conditions are not what we evolved for, and that they are abnormal. And that is why we have problems. He goes on to say, though, that there's a bunch of reasons that lead to that, but only in the presence of technology do they really break people. So I'm going to list off the things, but he says it's all of these things are okay if you choose them. All these things are okay in isolation, but it's technology that does the worst. I'll tell you what they are. It's excessive population density, isolation of man from nature, and a breakdown of natural small-scale communities, such as the extended family, the village, or the tribe. And this, so that is very important. I'll tell you about that in a second. And this last one, I think, is the most important, excessive rapidity of social change, which leads to having no stable framework. And that is due to technology. And I remember reading Tragedy and Hope, and I absolutely wish that I could find this passage. The book is like 900 pages long. And it said in there that, this Carol Quigley, it said something like the number one way that you can change a culture is by separating the parents from the children. And the best way to do that is technology, which changes values. And I don't know if he used the example, but I use the example of the birth control pill in the 60s. That's a technology. And what it did was it separated sex from children, which meant that you could have premarital sex because you didn't need to actually have a partner who could help you when you were pregnant. And that led to a value shift and a great schism between those baby boomers who got the pill and their parents who fought in World War II. So that is really, really important. And we're seeing that exact same thing right now, where parents like me, I have teenagers who I don't even know how to navigate the world of electronics that they are into. You cannot, I've tried many, many times to control YouTube to like pay for an extra screener. YouTube doesn't allow it. Like I don't know if it was like media, kids media or something like that. I've been looking at many different places and they'll say YouTube does not allow it. So we have this technological change that is separating us from our kids and really changing their value system that we cannot help at all. And that is part of what's in the unstable. So it's hard to be a good parent when you don't understand the framework. And then the other thing I wanted to make sure you understand is that this idea of natural small-scale communities having to be undermined, which they are. Like it was the war, took the boys away. My mother said, oh, the country was never the same when they took all the farm boys and sent them to France. And then I see now to replace that, kids go to college in a different state. Why? Why do all the kids leave? Like, that's just messed up. If they get married there, they are going to, somebody's got to not live. If they go to Michigan, what's the chances that they're marrying somebody from, in my case right now, I live in LA. Like, it's not. So this is a way to break that up. And what he says is the reason that is a feature and not a bug, and that why conservatives are so wrong when they want economic growth and they say they want family values, is that when you have loyalty to your group, to your family, to your tribe, you are going to make decisions for them, not for the machine, which is why nepotism and discrimination are bad words, because they make you turn to your local, what's good for you on the local level or personally or in your family, and at the expense of the machine, the system. And he said the system could not survive if people had local interests.
Excellent points. You certainly see any competing tribe that isn't the state, the World Health Organization, is smashed as dumb and primitive and, you know, very small, which is bad. Because, of course, anyone who has a competing allegiance, well, it's like, well, the state tells me not to murder, but I got this Bible over here. It says, thou shall not murder. And then they tell me to steal, but this Bible tells me not to steal. There's this contradiction. The state hates that. So they're like, yes, compulsory education funded by the state. We're taking your house away if you don't chip in for the state. That's how vital it is. And even Emmanuel Macron refers to it as an extremist. Religious extremists are imposing their will on kids in France. So we really need to lock down on private schools. Private schools are the problem. The government controls like 95% of childhood education. And they're like, duh, that little 5%, that has to be the problem.
Oh, they are cracking down on private schools. I think that's what Operation Varsity Blues was about. But if you look at Skull and Bones, for example, or secret societies, their number one tenet is always prefer the in-group to the out-group. If you ever have a bonesman applying for a job, you must give that person. So that just, and think of how powerful they are or what positions of power they're in. That just shows you how powerful it is to put your in-group over the society at large, and why those very people are the ones who tell you not to prefer your own group. I'm totally a child of the melting pot. Like, I don't have those kind of tribal thoughts, and I do think that they've been fabricated just to cause conflict right now, promoted. But the reality is, it is a threat. I mean, I would think that they're being promoted just to put the last nail in the coffin.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, look at how beneficial it is to have a Skull and Bonesman as Secretary of War during Pearl Harbor, who is explicitly trying to provoke an incident in his own diaries with Japan. So Henry Simpson's his name. This is verified in John Tolan's book, Infamy. He back cites his own diary.
John Tolan's book was Backdoor to War, too.
You know what? The one that I'm thinking of is titled Infamy, Pearl Harbor, and Its Aftermath. I think it was published in 1986, where he cites Stimson, November 26th of 1941. And he says, we were doing everything we could to get Japan to strike first, or to make the first move into going into war. But yeah, there was an open plan of provocation. Roosevelt was in on it. He mentioned it to Churchill in Newfoundland. Arthur McCullen wrote a memo about how they could get this done. So it was a general understanding among the elites at the time. So yeah, getting your people in there. It's not just nepotism. Nepotism is the idiot at this gas station who takes forever to ring people out, and that's boring. This is straight up, this is how conspiracies are able to operate more or less in the open.
I just have to chime in, because it's another coincidence with my dad, is that he was in the Pacific in the Navy during World War II. I was the youngest of nine. I just have to try to defend myself against having a dad who's like a different generation like that. But I found, when he died, a book on his shelf. It was Backdoor to War by John Toland. It was is it John Toland?
Yeah, John Toland is
And this book was a first edition. It was from the 50s, and it had, it was totally annotated by my dad in the margins, who, I mean, he went to war to fight because of that. And then he found that it was such a scam. And in that book, Backdoor to War, it had the references and footnotes are almost exclusively out of State Department documents. So that is very, very well documented. But I just think it's fun that you're bringing up these references that I was raised on.
Is it Backdoor to War, the Roosevelt Foreign Policy, 1933 to 1941?
Yes, and it was originally published, I think, in the 50s.
Okay. Yeah, it's amazing. Even guys like George Morgenstern were publishing in the late 40s about it. Okay, back to Kaczynski. I always have to get a Pearl Harbor line in somewhere.
That's great. I'm so pleased. Very, very. I can't remember anyone ever making reference to Tolland in my experience. Okay.
Sixth point?
My sixth point is, there are three types of drives. I think it's weird to call them drives, but he says that one is takes minimum effort to achieve. The next takes a lot of effort to achieve. And the third is unsatisfiable. So he says you have these three drives, and some you achieve, some you don't. Some of the ones that you achieve are easy and some are hard. For the easy, he said, we evolved in a world where the necessities of life came in the second category, which was achievable but difficult. So what his life was, Kaczynski chose to make his life that, where he just like lived off the land or made his own stuff out of scrap and yada yada. So he said what's happened is the necessities of life, for the most part, have been moved into the minimal effort category, which is not satisfying to us, because then it isn't a hard goal, but we can achieve it. The much effort achievable ones a lot of times are like these surrogate activities. He said, but there, unfortunately for us, some of the necessities have been moved into the third category, which is unsatisfiable. And that can't have been true evolutionarily, because necessities had to have all been satisfied for us to make it this far. He gives an example of that as security. He said, we have this need for security, security in our person, in our ability to get the resources that we need. And he uses one example. I'm going to use a different one. He goes on about, in a few cases, how he quotes a Harvard law professor saying that all the important decisions in the world are made by maybe 500 or 1,000 people, not a lot. Kaczynski talks about how scientists working on nuclear power or CERN or string theory or whatever, he said that they are taking a non-zero risk of destroying the universe, you know, setting off a chain reaction, a non-zero risk. And in their minds, they have 80 years of life. This non-zero risk of them dying now versus 80 years, you know, 50 years from now is acceptable to them because the risk of glory is so, so much higher. But they're taking your life into, and you have no control over it. You know that nuclear war, you have no control over it. And you know that. And it's very stressful and agitating. And I agree with that. And then when I saw the COVID thing come down, I thought of him because I thought, wow, I didn't even realize that these necessities, which seem to be, which he said were in the first category of easily achievable, low effort, no autonomy, but still totally achievable stuff of getting your food and everything. I now realize that not only is it no autonomy, but you can't have any security that it will ever be satisfied if those people upon whom you rely, that you have no control over, decide to turn that spigot off. So that's it, those three types of drives. And we really should have the necessities in the middle one, which is difficult but achievable. That goes to the power principle. We don't have that.
Yeah, those are all really important. I forget where. So I think it was on page 118. He talks about assistance versus spoiling. He uses the example of a chess game. This is in the notes on like the second to last page. He says, so if you are playing in a chess game and you're really trying to win, you're putting in effort, it really helps if someone comes in and whispers something into your ear that helps you out, gives you an advantage. But what if someone just set you aside and a chess master did all the moves for you and then you won? Well, you've now gone from assisting someone in a win to spoiling the entire game, making the game redundant. So while it's important that people want things assisted, they want things assisted in their life to make it easier, they don't want things spoiled. The exact quote is, the system, referring to the Industrial Revolution, makes an individual's life easier for him in innumerable ways, but in doing so, it deprives him of control over his own fate. So that's where he gets the chess example. And I thought that that was a second point in which he reiterates what you had just said.
I have a great example of that. Did you ever make a boxed cake or boxed cornbread or whatever? You put like an egg in it and a half a cup of oil. Yeah. So when those mixes first came out, I think in the 50s, they had nothing. You didn't have to add anything but water. And women didn't like it because it didn't make them feel like it was homemade. So they changed the recipe to require that you add something. Just adding one thing makes you feel like you did it.
Wow, that is interesting.
And to this day, you do.
Because cooking's never been my thing, I guess I've never wondered, why are we eating at home? There's all these dishes and all this stuff. Can't we just go out? It's so expensive sometimes to get all the little things. It's easier if we go to YC's Mongolian Grill because they already have it there and we're saving money and time.
It's actually cheaper. Yeah. And now they have Blue Apron and stuff where they bring all the raw food to your house, which seems so gross to me. And they cut it up for you or whatever. They make it into portions. They give you the recipe. I think I haven't seen it personally, but that's what it looks like on the commercials. And I'm thinking, I don't know. I guess it saves you a grocery. I mean, it is easier, but you could take it one more step and just order in, pick it up on your way home or something. I mean, it has value. I've gotten services like that. I'm not saying I don't like them, but it doesn't always save you money or time or effort.
Exactly. What is your seventh takeaway?
Okay. So some of these things we clumped together. Okay. Okay. He wrote this, Kaczynski wrote this decades ago. But he said at the time that in about 10 years, it would be too late to resist the technological machine, because they would have such total surveillance over us that we could never get the jump on them. So if we wanted to break free of technology, and I'll tell you my eighth point, what that would entail, or I can actually make it a part of this one. So his idea was, he said, all the revolution has to destroy all technology, completely 100% all technology. So anybody who wants to help you lead a revolution against the technological society, if they intend to retain anything for their own personal use, then you cannot follow them, because there will be a slippery slope. And when I talk to my friend Bellamy, the permaculturist, he really gets into this stuff. He's like a very brainy writer guy. And he, author, and he says that there are some people who even question the value of fire, that like, we can't even use fire. Fire is like the ultimate technology, right? So I don't go for that. Actually, our bodies have evolved to eat cooked food. So I don't think we could actually survive. Like, we have become symbiotic with the technology in that way. And that's another point Kaczynski makes. He says, as technology gets further away from our physical ability to deal in a society determined by it, we'll have to get more and more aids, such as stress-relieving medication or eyeglasses. Like, we need biological technology. That could even go to the Great Reset, to Klaus Schwab, to the World Economic Forum, where if you look at what that's all based on, it's based on their fourth industrial revolution, the World Economic Forum, and that it defined it by blurring the lines between biology and technology. And that was anticipated by Kaczynski. And that's why he says you guys got to blow it all up.
Amazing stuff. On page 110, he talks about how all of these things are getting so out of our hands, and that is extremely stressful and difficult to deal with. He says, it may be argued that the majority of people don't want to make their own decisions, but want leaders to do their thinking for them. We see this all the time when people say, well, it's the law, or I follow the science. It's much easier than actually doing any thinking. But he goes on to say, it does not follow that they like to have decisions imposed upon them without having the opportunity to influence those decisions. Well, what about the scam of democracy does that say? You get a 1 in a billion vote once every 4 years between two crooks, and people are like, well, they work for me. I'm the boss. I really call the shots, not the guy who can make executive orders and has the right to murder me if I resist him. Isn't it unbelievable that just that alone gives people so much buy-in to the system that even this little voting thing, when the reality is only anarcho-capitalists are the only game in town with you having influence. It's like everyone else either believes in statism, or even the ANCOMs don't recognize your right to contract. So we're really the only ones saying you have the freedom to disassociate with bad actors. No one else says that except us. So really, we're the ones who need to be taking this argument and expanding it to everyone. Any thoughts on that, or your next point?
Let's bring in Etienne's La Boetie first on that, with the consent of the governed. It's, to me, not, it's even worse than that. It's even worse than saying I have control over this guy because I voted for him. What you actually say most of the time is, I voted for my guy. My guy lost, but I defer to the guy who won, because other people chose him and I recognize their equality to me. But what you're recognizing is what you're implicitly recognizing is that anybody or the collective has the right to dominate you. And I think that because the powers that be want a kind of paradigm shift right now, and in order to do that, they need to kind of have a teardown scenario, Great Reset, a rebooting. They want the conflict. And that's why for the past 20 years, there has been this illegitimacy emerging into the democratic process. So there was the hanging chad in 2000. There's the Diebold voting machines in 2004, in 2008, and 2012 was Obama's Kenyan birth. You know, these are all the stories. And then in 2016, you had Trump having the Russian collusion. But if it had been Hillary, it would have been illegal immigrants. If it had been Ted Cruz, it would have been that he was not qualified because he was Canadian, which he was. So I feel like that was all a setup for that. So they're taking away the harmony that delusion has imparted on us. So we're going to see that go away. But I think it's worse even than he explained it to me. And then I'll tell you my next point, my eighth point, is that it's that society is, and this maybe goes a little bit to the idea that our liberty is delusional or curated for us, that society is very permissive in matters that aren't important. So premarital sex is totally fine as long as it isn't procreative. But anything like who we go to war with, you know, is something that, well, be above my pay grade, or they can't tell us this stuff because of national security. So we have no control over it or even a transparency into it, but we do accept this delusion of freedom because of unimportant things.
Well, what is the corporate press and the mainstream media, besides getting us to focus on nonsense that is rather trivial? And they explicitly say that it's trivial when they focus on it one day, and then the next day is about something completely different, as though, you know, it was never a big deal. Assad is going to kill the Kurds. There's overpopulation. The ozone layer is shrinking. That was so yesterday. No, but it's still happening and it's going to kill us, right? Yeah, but, you know, we really got to focus on Stormy Daniels. They are constantly filling us with things that are so trivial and they have all these opinions on it. Do you think government has the right to do something no one else has? You say you're against monopolies. Do they have a monopoly on taxation? If it was okay, we could all do it, right? They're not really interested in that. That's like boring and philosophical and dull. Exactly. Money printing.
Yeah, that really wouldn't even be like the violence of taxation. It's a
and
you
even,
know,
even you when you try to print a different currency, like the Liberty Dollar, that guy went to jail. Trading Bitcoin without a license is what the Free State Live guys were charged with. So
I bet if you tried to mint gold coins, you would get arrested. Like actually gold, just gold, like basically an ounce of gold. Like it wouldn't even have to have any authority behind it. But if you tried to use that as money, I think that would actually be in it could potentially be in violation of the Constitution. I have to reread that sentence, but okay.
Ridiculous. Point number eight.
Nine. That was it.
I'm sorry, nine, yes.
Because I'm getting low here. I can't, I had like 15, but I mushed a bunch of them together. So this is one that I think I don't want to gloss over because it's very important to us. And I think it's being intentionally undermined on many levels. But this autonomy in achievement of difficult goals, he says, gives self-esteem, self-confidence, and a sense of power. And those things were to gut us of that was essential in the power that they exerted over us in the lockdown. Like all this lockdown stuff would not have worked if we had actual autonomy or the sense of self-respect that having autonomy would have brought us. And I've often thought that too, because like there was the Ukrainian the coup that we did in Ukraine, and the Russian sectors, the Russian counties out in the east, they had to rebel because they spoke Russian. And the first thing they did in the post-coup Ukraine, where our Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, was caught red-handed on tape plotting the overthrow of the democratically elected president in 2013, I think it was. But in any case, of Ukraine, one of the first things they did was outlaw Russian as a language that could be used officially. So the people had to, but they're still fighting that because those people were like the industrialists, the farmers. They had been fought in wars before. You cannot dominate people like that. They'll fight to the death. You see those grizzled, hardcore guys saying, like, don't send your people over here. Just send the guns. We know what to do with them. And I thought, man, this is why Patrick Henry said you can't have something to the effect of you cannot have freedom if you don't have an agricultural society. And I think there's so much to that, not because like I want natural food, although I do, but because there you are in total control of your necessities, in defense of your physical property. You'd be like Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death. You can't dominate those.
He makes a great point on page 114 about the Second Amendment crowd, how they will justify any expansion under George Bush and Donald Trump. But so long as you don't take my guns while saying I'm anti-gun. Because if you just do a bump stock ban like Trump, well, then that's fine. Reagan's assault weapons, whatever they called it at the time. So on page 114, he says, the real issue is not whether society provides well or poorly for people's security. The trouble is that people are dependent on the system for their security rather than having it in their own hands. This, by the way, is part of the reason why some people get worked up about the right to bear arms. Possession of a gun puts that aspect of their security in their own hands. I mean, really, if you talk to the gun people, even Crowder was asked, so you're going to shoot and kill American police officers and military members? He said, I never said that. Even though the claim is we're using these against the government, as if like it's the Capitol building itself. That is what government is, a structure that could be shot at. Of course, it's people imposing the laws of the politicians, but they can't even make that. So what the gun serves as is the aspect of their security in their own hands. And that I just think, that just stood out to me as, oh, now it makes sense why they love guns. Because it has nothing to do with resisting the state. Every time I ask them that, I'm an evil cop killer wannabe. So finally that makes sense.
I have I coined a couple of terms that reflect what you're talking about there. I said, if you notice, first of all, I had a caller on the WSB show who said to me, and I'll never forget it, I wish I remembered his name. He said, the Democrats aren't going to get your guns. It will take a Republican because you're on your guard against Democrats. And that made me coin a term called the contrary law of democracy. The worst thing that you can imagine the government doing to you is going to come from your side because they're the ones you're not fighting against. So whatever you don't want is going to come from your own side. But that isn't the term I that addresses what you were talking about. I said they're always after resistance grade weaponry, never target justifying weaponry. So when you look at gun crime or gun deaths or homicide or whatever, it's almost entirely handguns. They never talk about coming after handguns. They only talk about stuff that could actually put up a fight if they stepped over their bounds that we're willing to accept as far as government overreach. So they want to take all the stuff that can actually mount a resistance from something a little more organized, but they don't take the handguns away, not just not to make trouble, and maybe they want the handguns, but they don't really make real trouble looking for that. They don't justify it. They really could, because I think when they come down with their tanks and you come out with your handgun, they get to kill you.
Yeah, those were some of my favorite memes ever of you idiot, you can't take on the government with, you know, one AR-15. By the way, a bunch of people almost overthrew the government on January 6th with no guns. AOC and Rashida Tlaib are still crying about it. Joe Biden shakes every time. Brian Stelter mentions it on CNN. So,
sticks are the new long gun. That's all those guys have. My last point.
Yeah.
All right. This is the biggest point, in my opinion, or I should say the most food for thought and the thing that we have to come to our own conclusions about. He said that this technological machine that our society, our leaders, whomever, are creating may or may not, but may actually get out of their control. He was not like the conspiracy theorist of what I think of. And now that he's in jail, that he's had correspondences, especially with, I think, Scribina, who did the introduction to this book. He's a professor. But he doesn't understand the true nature of 9/11 or anything like that, because they don't let him read anything but like the USA Today. That was the last I saw. So he's not saying like, oh, they're plotting to put in this technological society for pure surveillance and yada yada. I actually think they are. But for what it's worth, what he said was they may be building this on purpose, but they may not be able to control it, as the machines that they build need machines to run them. So when they start building stuff so complicated that they cannot run it, and there are increasingly layers of technology between them and the technology, the most sophisticated technology, then you could have a Terminator scenario.
That is, you know, as scary as it is, that's so similar, because when I worked in IT, it was like the more you'd go up the ladder, it was still very vague. So even when I'd get promoted and they'd show me even more stuff, you know, you're like putting the CPU into the RAM and using this system. I go, this could be done with very little education, yet it's so complex. How high do I have to go to know how the CPU, the what is it, central processing unit or something like that, how that's actually made? And it's very few people. And when they start using machines that use machines that use machines ad infinitum, that it actually might be out of their hand. We could have the nicest people on the planet Earth, Klaus Schwab, dead for 100 years, and it's still happening, beyond beyond their control. I love the point he makes on page 12. They claim they want preservation, but what they really want is integration. Now, this is so often the case where they'll say, self-determination was Woodrow Wilson's justification for World War I. The guy didn't think of any sort of self-determination. What he wanted was people integrating into, you know, what you or I would call a new world order. The British Empire was preserving Belgian neutrality while they expanded 950,000 acres of the empire. Today, we see this where, the poor siding with their nations in World War I instead of there being a revolutionary class resistance, as Marx thought. But when it comes to, say, a woman's right to choose, so often the narrative, while it's saying, we want you to preserve your own integrity, it's much more about integrating it with everything the left and the state always believe. We really care about blacks, but when blacks vote for Trump or blacks support school choice,
or have guns,
blacks under the bus or guns. Yeah, school choice is the big one that always comes up, because like almost all the blacks you speak with will be in favor of really wanting to send their kid to the other school that they already have to pay for, but they're not allowed to. Caring about the poor, but when the poor vote for Brexit or the poor vote for Trump, screw the proletariat. They're a bunch of racists. Honestly, I hope they get replaced with immigrants. Minorities questioning the vaccine.
Yes.
Instead of being very calm and, you know, citing, you know, scientific research and the reason we should just do it, ugh, idiot conspiracy theorists. God, we need to make this mandatory.
Keep your eyes open for what Biden's doing in the Western Hemisphere, in the Caribbean, in Central America, in South America. This stuff, I just exposed today on my show, on the Propaganda Report, that there was an attempted coup against the recently assassinated president of Haiti in February, right after Biden took office. And they had evidence that it was U.S. directed. And some of the congressmen, Democrat congressmen from New York, were in support of overthrowing this Moïse. And now he's gone. And I feel like, as CNN wrote a cover-up this morning saying, not about that, but saying, oh, Biden doesn't want to turn his attention to the Western Hemisphere, but I guess he has to. I uncovered an article that a speech he gave, or an article he wrote, Biden, in December 2018, saying it is time for us to reassert our influence over the Western Hemisphere. So I consider that to be neocolonialism, exploiting the poor, exploiting people of color at the hands of this like old white guy who they, act like replaced the racist old white guy who came before him. And I will say, in that I'm not a Trump supporter, but my guess is it's my contrary law of democracy. You are going to get the opposite of what you say you want.
Yeah. And so Jimmy Dore had this whole thing where he was going to force the vote to pressure Nancy Pelosi. The squad was going to withhold their votes from Pelosi unless they brought a expansion on Medicare to the floor. And his whole point was, the squad has these votes. You need to leverage them. And then we're actually going to get Pelosi to, you know, stop supporting the corporate interests and go for the people, whatever. So the squad didn't do it. But they finally did it like a month ago. And the bill that they leveraged their votes on, while the AOC voted not present and the others voted for it, was to increase funding for the police. This is the defund the police bill. Well, because the increase was, does the Capitol needs more protection, so we need billions of dollars for the Capitol Police.
Yes.
By the way, it's not just the Capitol Police, it's police all around, so we could stop people from coming to the Capitol. So the squad finally leverages their votes, and the bill is to fund the police, the thing they ran against for, like, what, 2 years since George Floyd's thing? Unbelievable stuff. I love that that term of yours.
Contrary law of democracy.
Contrary law of democracy. Any final takeaways you have from the book that you think the audience would appreciate?
No, I mean, I think what I walk around with all the time is the power principle, this need for autonomy in acquisition of your necessities. And when COVID came down, it was so weird to me that I had just read this book. I don't know how I got to this, exposed to the fact this book existed. I think I was watching like a Forensic Files or something. And I could not, it could not have drawn more of a of an example for me than that COVID immediately shut down. And I thought, wow, I'm conditioned white here. I'm like unprepared and unaware. And Kaczynski was right. And it seems theoretical, but it's actually quite practical. And I think homesteading and agorism are two great ways to kind of, I mean, I'm not telling you not to use fire. I just am saying those are good ways to disconnect from a system that who must rob you of your autonomy, and it is not too late. And I think by asserting our autonomy when it comes to necessities, then we are doing more to fight the system than anything else we can do.
Exactly. Yeah, and I'll just end on a quote from the book to reiterate what the power process is that he's referring to. Consider the hypothetical of a man who can have anything he wants just by wishing for it. Such a man has power, but he will develop serious psychological problems. At first, he will have a lot of fun, but by and by, he will become acutely bored and demoralized. Hunter Biden. Eventually, he may become clinically depressed. History shows that leisured aristocracies tend to become decadent. This is not true of fighting aristocracies that have to struggle to maintain their power. I thought that was so true because I think of every spoiled brat in the royal family. You know, Prince William always got this terrible thing, and poor Meghan Markle has all these terrible problems. And one time someone asked what race the baby might be. Oh God, this is terrible. But as a Jewish family, we've had that conversation, I don't know, 50 times about marrying within Jew. So for her to say that, they need these problems because they need something to overcome for this power principle to take place.
And maybe that is what they're imparting to our youth, is this idleness that leads to psychosis.
Exactly. So I know you have a lot of episodes of your show. Well done, by the way. If someone wants an introduction, let me link one episode so they could get a bird's eye view into what the show is about. What would that episode be? So I know to link it in the description.
Okay. I would say the best way to do it is it's Share the Show Tuesday today. So every Tuesday we have a kind of intro thing. I would say that, but now I'm going to say episode 187, where my partner and I, particularly my partner, Brad Binkley, came out with absolutely cracked the code on Black Lives Matters as a Black Lives Matter. When before people realized, like, there was all this Marxist history and everything, and he has clips of them saying what they're really all about, Patrice Cullors and stuff, her vision for the future. And also, I believe that's the episode that has the indivisible training, where they tell people, these are like upper middle class white chicks telling people to go out and protest and how to argue against folks who tell them not to get violent. It's really, really an interesting one. That's the Propaganda Report, episode 187.
Thank you to everyone for watching Keith Knight Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. Ms. Perez, thank you so much for your time.
It is an absolute pleasure.